Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Kay Ryan, our new poet laureate, has a question for you. Who would be a turtle who could help it? A barely mobile hard roll? A four-oared helmet? Actually, she has lots of questions, big questions that come in small packages of verse on the hardest part of being Harry Houdini, on hiding during hide-and-seek, on imaginary Eskimos, all of them really about how we live our lives. Joining me now from San Francisco is Kay Ryan. She's just been named the nation's 16th Poet Laureate and officially takes up her post in the fall. Kay, thanks very much for being here.
Well, I'm glad to be here, Tom.
It's wonderful to have you. I settled in last night with several volumes of your poetry and just had the greatest time. I didn't want to quit. I stayed up too late reading, even though they're short and compact. There's lots of them, and they're just wonderful. We're going to work you in this hour, since you're going to be working for us soon as our poet laureate, I guess. We hope you'll read a lot for us, Kay. Are you up for that?
Great. I sure am. They're kind of snack-sized poems, right?
Snack-sized poems, but the hook is deep, and you play with the big, big, big stuff here. I want to just dive in and start reading. We'll talk about other things as well, but, I mean, after all, your poems are what you've given us most importantly. Way back in Elephant Rocks, there's one called Imaginary Eskimos. If you've got that volume, I'd love it if you'd read it for us. It's page 30, Kay.
Page 30. Oh, thank you. That's going to be really handy if you do that for me.
You're welcome. And I should say, while you're going to it, to our listeners, if you want to read poems that you hear this hour and more, you can go to our website, onpointradio.org, and get linked out to a whole world of Kay Ryan's fabulous poetry.
I want to warn your listeners that this has a sort of a silly pun in it. Which isn't too unusual for my work. Oh, no. Okay, here we go. Imaginary Eskimos. Who knows if Eskimos choose to go with flows or just go, regretting motion, missing a fixed position vis-a-vis the ocean? It is common to suppose that anyone whom one is not is predisposed to like her lot. That when she drills down through the ice to fish and sees the black and restless drift and works against the cold occlusion which always threatens, it is easier for that sort of person.
Imaginary Eskimos. And you're having fun right away in that language, and we can hear it. And yet you're going to big ideas right away. I mean, whether... sort of, I don't know, is this free will and predetermination and the Eskimo, you know, whether the Eskimo is riding the ice flow or the ice flow is creating the Eskimo, you've got a good sense of humor, but you take it right down deep and right away.
Well, I'm glad you think so. Sometimes I get praised for being easy to read, and I always think, well, yeah. All the words are familiar.
Yeah, right. Like the earth is really to see it's round.
Yeah.
Like that's all there is to it. I love it. I love it. And
in this poem, I was thinking about how we really do see other people's lives as easier, more livable, less fraught.
Happening naturally somehow.
Yes, right. They're much more natural.
Whether they're choosing to go, who knows, but you say, whether they choose to go with flows or just go regretting motion.
Yes. Missing their fixed position vis-a-vis the ocean. But, of course, the terrible pun is going with the flow.
Yes, we know. We know. And there's this
I thought that might have gotten so antique now that nobody used it. Nobody would even recognize it.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe it's got a little 60s smell on it or 70s. I'm not sure.
I think so.
You get compared with some real greats, Emily Dickinson and John Donne and William Carlos Williams. But there's a little E.E. Cummings in you as well, isn't there, in that kind of jaunty rhyme and that you're playing with here?
Well, I don't know. I'd sort of put myself more in the Ogden Nash school.
Oh, Ogden Nash rhythm. That's who I should say. Yeah, that kind of.
I want to have massive, ridiculous fun with language. You know, no half measures. Well, no, I like half measures, but I like really full measures too.
you can be grand in that massive fun, but there's another poem here, and I think it's in Say Uncle. It's called Blandure, if that's how pronounce it.
I pronounce it, I don't know, having sort of a
Blandure.
I just say blandure.
Okay.
The way you'd say
grandeur.
It's just the way you'd say grandeur, except with a bl.
Okay, we'll take it. Blandure.
Got
it? From your collection, Say Uncle.
Okay, now I'm going to preface this by saying that one morning I just found this new word, blandure,
yes,
beside my bed on my very own Post-it note, so it must be my own creation.
You woke up maybe in the night and put it there, or maybe the hand of somebody reached down.
I don't know, but in any case, it's something that really fascinates me. I'm the kind of person who's always, you know, holding out my plate instead of saying, more please. You know, I say, less please. And this is one of those poems. Blandure. If it please God, let less happen. Even out earth's rondure. Flatten Eiger. Blanden the Grand Canyon. Make valleys slightly higher. Widen fissures to arable land. Remand your terrible glaciers and silence their calving. Halving or doubling all geographical features toward the mean. Unlean against our hearts. Withdraw your grandeur from these parts.
Blandur. And you know you're calling for that modest thing, but then, and I found this so characteristic reading through, you're not really modest. You want the Alps flattened and the Grand Canyon made bland. I mean, these are big requests. And you're talking to God in a way, which I found interestingly old-fashioned for a very kind of newfangled poet.
Well, I think that we should use all the fangles we can find, frankly. I would like to point out one really dismal element of this poem, and that is that the glaciers are beginning to silence their calving, aren't they?
Oh, yeah.
We say poetry makes nothing happen, but isn't it terrifying to think maybe it does?
I heard John Donne in this poem. Maybe I'm wrong, but that speaking right to God and asking almost in the imperative, you know, do this, do that. I mean, Holy Sonnet 14, or throw me and bend your force to break, blow, burn, and make me new. That kind of, and here you've got unlean against our hearts. Withdraw your grandeur from these parts. It's kind of grand speech to the Almighty there.
Well, you know, you have to try to be equal to the person you're talking to, huh? But I'd like to point out that there is a way to read, to see this as, by asking for less, one is, of course, praising the grandeur, you know, the almost unbearable grandeur of what it is to be alive and to see the glories of creation.
Can you give us a sense of when you began to open up to this ambition? The New York Times profiled you and said back in 1976 you rode a bicycle from California to Virginia in 80 days. You were up in the Hoosier Pass in the Colorado Rockies and felt an incredible opening up, and quoting you saying, an absence of boundaries, an absence of edges, as if my brain could do anything.
Exactly. I've always felt somewhat uncomfortable with the fact that that's true. I am really not the sort of person who's gone around seeking visions or that sort of thing, but I at that time I was about 30,
mm-hmm,
and I'd really been resisting the idea of being a poet because I was raised by people who didn't like drama, you know, who were simple people. This was all would be very foreign, what I'm doing right now. Didn't put on airs.
Your mother, very reserved, you've said. Your father,
very reserved.
Both in California there.
Mm-hmm. Right. My father was an oil well driller, although he had a wide range. He also did sewers and septic tanks.
You said he could fail at anything.
He could, yeah. I'm sort of sorry I said that. Wasn't too kind.
Forgive me, Dad.
It was true.
Right.
But in any case, I was resisting the fact that poetry was really kind of taking over my brain. I mean, it was My brain was rhyming. It was thinking of images. It was sort of writing poems without my entire permission. And I decided I had better figure out what I was going to do about this. So I thought this cross-country bicycle trip would be a very nice extended period of time during which I could think about whether I was going to be a writer. So then I, as you introduced, I had this experience up at the top of Hoosier Pass, or going up it. I was riding my bike with all the camping gear and everything on it, but by then I'd been riding for many hundreds of miles, and I was in very good shape. So I just had this incredible clarity and power, and I finally realized, after just fooling around with this gift I had for, I knew it would be very temporary, I thought, wow, this is my chance to ask the question. So I just asked, and I don't know, I don't have any idea who I was asking, but I asked, shall I be a writer? And the answer I received was so completely simple that it was irresistible. The answer was, do you like it? And I mean, I completely liked it. I was just resisting it. So I went back home, knowing what to do. I mean, in the sense of write, but having no idea how to do it. Because I still didn't want to be the kind of person who was terribly exposed. I didn't want to become what it seemed to me at that time in the early, in the mid-70s, what a poet was.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking with the next Poet Laureate of the United States, Californian Kay Ryan. She will step into those shoes this fall, and she's talking already in her new public capacity after many, many years of writing an awful lot of wonderful poems. She joins us from San Francisco. Kay, I promised we'd work you. We've already got your kind of moment of magic there in the high pass in the Rockies that opened you up. And the question in response to your question is, do you like it? You clearly do. Read some more for us, if you would. There's a great one here in Elephant Rock's A Cat, A Future. I don't have the page number. I should.
Let's try for that.
Got it. Excellent. Good luck for us. It's short. Listen closely, dear listeners.
You know, I still say before I read my poems, oh, this is a short one, and then I have to laugh because really they're all awfully short.
But pay attention.
A Cat, A Future. A cat can draw the blinds behind her eyes whenever she decides. Nothing alters in the stare itself, but she's not there. Likewise, a future can occlude, still sitting there, doing nothing rude.
A Cat, A Future, from Kay Ryan. I don't know when you wrote that. It must have been sometime in the 1990s. Does the future always have that kind of cat-eye ambiguity, now you see it, now you don't, about it? The future seems a lot on people's minds right now.
I don't know. I'm sure I was thinking that something had vanished. Something that still seemed to be there had vanished. Might have been in a personal relationship.
Mm-hmm. A cat can draw the blinds behind her eyes. If you take that to a personal relationship, what is that? Is that kind of transmogrification?
In the sense that someone can be there and not be there.
Absolutely. Right? A cat above all, or a person, but you've made it the future.
Oh, well, also, certainly anything can appear to still be there, and yet it's just the shell. It's really gone. Just like if you've looked into cat's eyes, you really do know that they have this marvelous, spooky ability to vanish inside themselves.
You have got so much. I mean, poems bring us all kinds of things. Yours seem to have big chunks of wisdom, in addition to all the fun and glory with language. What comes first to you? Are you out on a bicycle ride and it's some flash of insight, or is it a phrase?
That's a really good question. I mean, what comes first? I don't know that anybody ever exactly asked me that. First of all, I don't think about poems when I don't think about writing at all when I'm out on my bicycle. As a matter of fact, I don't think about writing at all until I sit down in silence, usually in the morning, and start writing. I'm not a person who gathers notebooks full of material or pieces things together over months. I sit down and maybe I've read something that is really thrilling to my mind in some little phrase like the will to divest, which became the mm-hmm. title of a poem of mine, mm-hmm. It just thrills me for some reason. I start thinking about what that would be, the will to divest, because it hits something inside me. But I do have certain ambitions for a poem, and you use the term wisdom. I wouldn't say that for myself, but I would say that I want a poem truly to say something, to get somewhere, to take an argument, even a crazy argument in some cases, and to take it somewhere, so that a poem really, really moves from a start to an ending. I have a great desire for a lot of language fun, I mean, in terms of rhyme of all sorts of embedded and strange kinds, and also for just, I hope, beautiful language. It may be simple, but I don't want any of the words to be waste words.
You mentioned that will to divest. It's in your volume, Say Uncle. It's page 17, Kay. Might as well hear it.
Might as well. Mm-hmm. Oh, thank you. This is something that Milan Kundera wrote. And his essays would be some of those that I might enjoy reading in the morning to get my brain activated. And he was admiring the composer Janáček, if I'm saying that right. Mm-hmm. And Janáček apparently strips a great deal away in his compositions.
So the great Czech writer thinking about the Janáček, and you come out with that will to divest, the stripping away.
Yes. So this is sort of the dark side of simplification. That will to divest. Action creates a taste for itself, meaning once you've swept the shelves of spoons and plates you kept for guests, it gets harder not to also simplify the larder, not to dismiss rooms, not to divest yourself of all the chairs but one, not to test what singleness can bear once you've begun.
That will to divest, Kay Ryan's, from Kay Ryan's volume, Say Uncle. That theme comes up already, and we just picked a few poems, and you've got this blandeur, strip away, flatten out the Grand Canyon, be careful of action itself. Are you saying that you welcome the action that wants to strip away, or that it's dangerous?
Well, I think in this poem it's clearly dangerous. The poem begins, action creates a taste for itself, mm-hmm. which would apply to any action. I mean, being busy creates an appetite for being busier, right? Having friends creates an appetite for having more friends.
But that's often celebrated. I remember something from Goethe where he says, there's I think, magic and power in action. Of course,
right, but
we
but
saw where it, Germany went.
Here's the paradox, or here's the irony, I suppose, and that is that inaction creates an appetite for more inaction, or simplicity can, or simplification can create an appetite that so strips one down that one winds up being nothing.
Mm-hmm.
So there are dangers inherent in everything. We like to think of simplicity as being just a pure virtue, right? Mm-hmm. But it can also be a danger.
There's another here from your latest volume, The Niagara River, is what you call it, the title poem, I guess. And it speaks to, it's pretty clear, but we know where the Niagara goes, hypothetically, but if you're floating the Niagara, you're not exactly thinking about that. I guess there's a death theme here. Could you read it for us?
I sure could. Hmm. That was a very good introduction. I called the poem The Niagara River specifically so that it wouldn't mention the main thing about the Niagara, but it would bring it up, you know, make it sort of loom in your mind. So here's the poem. The Niagara River. As though the river were a floor, we position our table and chairs upon it, eat, and have conversation. As it moves along, we notice, as calmly as though dining room paintings were being replaced, the changing scenes along the shore. We do know this is the Niagara River, but it is hard to remember what that means.
And of course, right on the cover of the book, you have a painting of the thundering falls that await anyone who rambles down that river. Though we think of it as a floor, we think of it as a stationary dining room, practically. But you won't let us right there. I just love that. Remember, you know, what trip you're on here, folks.
Yeah, remember. You know, I was very proud of myself for having written this short, brutal poem. And then I was at a poetry festival, and there was everybody was given T-shirts, and on the back of the T-shirt was a poem by Isa, you know, the Japanese haiku poet. Mm. And I don't have the words quite right, but this is what it said in essence. Insects on a branch floating down the river, still singing. And I thought, that poem is so much better than mine.
Straight to it.
It made mine look verbose, you know.
Yeah. Wow, that's some self-charge to make for Kay Ryan. I cannot call you verbose. I'm sorry. It's not haiku, but Kay Ryan's poetry is a long way from verbose. Kay Ryan joins us from San Francisco, and right now we've got Danielle calling from Beaufort, South Carolina. Danielle, you're on the air with Kay Ryan.
Yes, I am. Hello, Tom.
Hi.
I had one question for Kay. The main thing to me, both my husband and myself used to be professors of literature, so you can imagine. Mm. But we are wondering, we saw a lot of one poet laureate like Robert Pensky. Apparently, he made himself available. What's Key's opinion about that? And I know on the one hand, literary people want exposure, but is it the choice of the poet laureate? Is it the choice of the station? You at PBS are doing a lot, but I'm just wondering.
Just how public a poet laureate must or might be.
Yes.
Kay Ryan, how do you look at it? Some have been very much out there. Robert Pinsky's been very generous over the years with his time with us and others, and he's not alone in that, but not everybody wants to step up and out during that year or more that they're poet laureate. How are you looking at it?
I think that was really an excellent question, and really it's one that I am, in a sense, struggling with because I'm not a very public person. I have intentionally kept my life one that hasn't involved the large halls too much or teaching beyond the level of remedial English in a community college. So it comes as kind of a new question, how public and in truly how generous I am. I don't quite know. I haven't figured out a project. There's kind of a history of that. Some poets laureates seem to do it, and others don't, as you said. One thing that I would like to point out, and I think really Danielle was maybe getting at this, is that poetry itself isn't it isn't really one of the do-gooding things. I mean, it may help us sometimes, but it's also a very bitey thing. You know, it's a ferocious thing. I think sometimes the role of the poet laureate gets so confused with being a person who does good that we can sort of start thinking that poetry is a social tool in some way or useful in some way. That I'm terribly selfish about poetry. If I find a poet that really excites me, what I want to do is not tell anybody. I just want to have this
just you and
this,
the poet. Why?
That's right.
Why?
That's right. Oh, well, I mean, I'm exaggerating, but Because I think that the real nature of one's relationship with a poem is that poem, if it's important to you, it is so interior, it's almost frightening. It's a very private thing, and it almost has nothing to do with the external world, even though we use poems in large public ways. But it's a kind of communication that is, when you read a poem that really affects you, in a sense you feel that you're half creating it, because you feel, oh, how could he know that about me, you know? And so there's this deep exchange that doesn't have much to do with the large world of public language.
And you get right down there. There's one here, chemise. How do you say it?
Yeah, chemise. I think you do. It's that little garment that women wear.
I don't even know how to say it, but you use it. You say, "What would the self disrobed look like? The form undraped. There is a flimsy cloth we can't take off. Some last chemise we can't escape. A hope more intimate than paint to please." You can't get much more intimate than that. The last little wisp that what surrounds ourself, whatever that is.
Isn't it kind of horrible to think that we have so deeply embedded in us a desire to please? You know?
I can think of worse desires.
I suppose, but it can be a tyranny. And to think that it's so deep in us. I don't know. It shocked me into thinking about it.
We've got a challenge here from Ward in Lake Placid, New York. Ward, you're on the air with Kay Ryan.
Hi, Kay.
Hello, Ward.
My thought is that poetry has become somewhat irrelevant in society at large. And I think poetry is about language. It's about shaping and changing language. You have any thoughts on that?
I sure do. I couldn't agree with you more. I'm not in terms of irrelevant to the world, because poetry just simply doesn't have to worry about it. It's like money, you know. Even if it gets lost, it still holds its value, and it'll be right there when somebody picks it up, somebody who wants it and sees it. But as you said about poetry's holding and shaping language, my feeling is that poetry has a really big challenge always, because I do think it's the preserver of language and the extender of language. But happily, the only way that poetry can do that is by people wanting to remember it. It has to stick in us because we love it. We have to hold on to it because it pleases us to hold on to it. And that's how something's saved. That's how clichés are saved. I mean, clichés are beautiful phrases that have been used and used and used so that they're profoundly embedded in our language. And so it's the challenge always of poetry to be so memorable that it lasts. Of course, we can't do that most of the time, but we can certainly aim for it.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with the next poet laureate of the United States, Californian Kay Ryan. She's been heaped with prizes for her work in volumes Say Uncle, Elephant Rock, the Niagara River. Kay, we have Donna calling from Quincy, Massachusetts. Donna, you're on the air with the next poet laureate.
And it's a privilege. Hey, Tom. Hi, Kay. How are you?
Good.
Hi.
We have a shared experience. I teach at a community college also. And what I was curious about is we're living in a world right now where a lot of kids get no exposure to poetry whatsoever. It's all about, like, you know, preparing for taking tests and, you know, blah, blah, blah. How do you, as a poet, find that the young people that you teach react to your poetry? Are they interested in it? Do they want to learn about poetry?
Do they know you're a poet?
Oh, gee. I have always kept my lives very separate from one another. I have my teaching life, and I have my writing life, and I have intentionally not taught literature or creative writing or particularly poetry, so that I could have that world to myself for my, you know, I can barely stand my own struggles. I really don't think I could endure the struggles of others. So I've really kept it separate. And I've always thought that the classroom was a place where I couldn't take advantage of my students, and even if they would say, "Oh, please read your poems" or that sort of thing, I always felt like, "Nope, you're in a trapped situation. If you want to hear my poems, I want you to come to me freely and hear them elsewhere." So, I really don't have a very good answer for that, but I'm all for tons of poetry in schools, naturally.
Who are your students in remedial English classes at the community college there, by and large?
Well, I teach at College of Marin, just above San Francisco, just across the Golden Gate Bridge. And I have a large ESL contingent of students.
English as a second language.
Yeah. English as a second language, right. I have students who, for one reason or another, didn't succeed very well in, or weren't very happy in school when they tried it earlier, and they've come back. I have a few students straight out of high school, but not so many in Marin. Most Marin students go on to other schools, straight out of high school. But my students are people who are there because they really need something and really want it. I usually teach at night, and they're very sincere. I love working with them. They'll come in dirty from their job, doing yard work or whatever day job they have, and they're there. They're taking it right out of their life. They're tired, and they're there to learn. They have an immediate application. They need this to get along. They need it to get a job in a bank or the drugstore or wherever.
You know, there's so many I want you to read, but there's one. It's called Dutch. I think it's in Say Uncle, page 58. If you've got that, Kay.
Got it.
And you remind me of it with your thought of people out working hard, kind of holding the world together, and then.
Oh,
other
good.
Sorts of people maybe as well.
Yeah, good. Yes, this is sort of one for the proletariat here. Dutch. Much of life is Dutch one-digit operations, in which legions of big, robust people crouch behind badly cracked dike systems attached by the thumbs. Their wide, balloon-pantsed rumps upended to the northern sun, while back in town, little black suspendered tulip magnates stride around.
I loved that so much.
I'm probably going to hear from the Dutch consulate and say,
right.
Boy, are you ever using some hideous stereotypes.
What's
here?
What's wrong with tulip magnets? Little black suspendered tulip magnates stride around.
Yeah, I always think of Groucho Marx marching around, you know.
Do you have that sense of people, you know, one at a time out there holding the world together, chaos at bay or whatever.
And they're
may
all
be.
Stuck, yeah.
Yes, with their finger in the neck. They can't move, but the little black suspended tulip magnets
stride
around.
Right.
I just love it. Let's go to Noel calling from Canton, New York. Hi, Noel. You're on the air with Kay Ryan. Noel, are you there?
Hello, yes. This is Noel.
Hi. You're on.
Thank you. I just want to say that I can so identify with Kay. In addition to her sense of humor, snack-sized poems have been coming through me since 1962. And let me end with saying, I want to be Kay Ryan when I grow up.
Oh no. she begs to warn you.
Be careful what you wish for.
Right. Noelle, thanks very much for that. Let's get more. I just want to hear the fabric of life. I love this one as well. It starts off a little funny, but it's deadly serious. It's page 25.
Which book?
Yeah, that's what
I should know.
You
know?
You should know. I should know.
Oh, got it.
Great.
Yeah,
wonderful.
It's in Say Uncle.
Oh, okay, Say Uncle. Good.
You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to make a list of all my poems alphabetically. You know,
yes, good
say
idea.
What,
an index
what book
to tattoo.
Right. I'm going to do it. I'm going to have to.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. So I want to tell you, of course, we all talk about the fabric of life.
Yes.
And I was thinking about it, I'm sorry to say, because a dear friend of mine, very much in the fabric of my life, took his life. And it was shocking the way that disrupted a larger world than I would have imagined.
Mm-hmm.
So here's this poem, The Fabric of Life. It is very stretchy. We know that, even if many details remain sketchy. It is complexly woven. That much, too, has pretty well been proven. We are loath to continue our lessons, which consist of slaps as sharp and dispersed as bee stings from a smashed nest when any strand snaps. Hurts working far past the locus of rupture, attacking threads far beyond anything we would have said connects.
It's short, but it's much more than a snack there.
You know, one thing I only realized about this a lot later was that it's got that image of slaps as sharp and dispersed as bee stings from a smashed nest. One time I was over at my friend's house who took his life, and I was standing on his porch, and he had a Japanese bell. And he was out in his backyard hanging up laundry, and I was standing there fooling with the bell. And I put my hand up inside it, and it was full of wasps, and I got stung all over. And I didn't realize that at all when I was writing it. And then much later, I saw the connection. I don't know if it was operating, you know, somewhere inside me or if it wasn't, but it struck me later as a strange coincidence.
You make those connections again and again. I mean, here's one that anybody who's paying attention over time sees more and more clearly. I mean, it bears hearing it again. You say, when any strand snaps, hurts working far past the locus of rupture, attacking threads far beyond anything we would have said connects. The way things are so interconnected in this world, it seems in a way we're grateful to a poet for saying so. I mean, it's just that you use language, but you just say things people don't normally say, but they're so true and important.
Well, you know, I want to say that it doesn't do me a bit of good. I just go right out and be as unwise as ever. It's one of the sufferings that wisdom seems to remain in the poems. If there is wisdom, it stays right where it is. I never get any wiser.
Well, maybe we will. How about, I love this one, Almost Without Surface. It's page 36. And again, I've pulled these out of the book, and so Doug,
I think that's in. I think that's Niagara River.
You're probably right. Yes, it is.
Yeah.
Yes, it is.
Got it. Okay. Almost Without Surface. Sometimes before going to sleep, a person senses the give behind the last given. Almost physically, like the strain of plush against a skin. The person imagines a fig or peach, perhaps a woman or a deep constellation, some fathomless fruit. But we are each that while we live, however much we resist, almost without surface, barely contained, but crazy as clouds compounding each other, refusing to rain.
Almost without surface. That is, we're almost without surface.
That's the proposition of the poem.
Without boundaries, then?
Well, without outside, however thick we think it is.
Sensing the give behind the last given. I love that. What a great line. Just great. And I don't want to stop because, you know, you're going to be poet laureate for a while, but I don't know when we'll get to talk with you again. I have to ask you about one thing. There's a kind of trick you often have in your poems. Toward the end, you go off in lots of directions, and then you get kind of focused on the rhythm, it seems to me, as the poem comes to a conclusion. And you like this kind of jazzy backflip in the rhythm. There's one poetry in translation. You say, it is so snug, the skin of the living animal stretched out to a rug, shaped something like the United States. One meditates upon a Florida-like flap, a forward leg which ran the Russian steppes, perhaps? And that's so, that little snicker snack at the end is comes through so often. I mean, do you love it? Do you not feel complete unless you've got it? Is it a poet's tick?
Well, you know, I suppose, I mean, I would hate to think it were a trick or a tick, but it probably is. It's got to do with some kind of interior rhythm. I mean, you know, what comes out is what is most pleasing to me, hopefully. You know, I mean, that's my goal, is to first please myself. I do like a lot of jazzy rhythm, and I like the demotic. You know, I like ordinary speech as well as highfalutin speech, and I like things said in a way that's very idiomatic sometimes. So I think you'll find that, and I think it's kind of relaxing to us. It's not frightening.
I love it.
But
I mean,
I don't do it to make people like it. I do it because I like it.
Oh, it's very pleasing, like a good riff, like a good jazz riff. I enjoy it enormously. But
I'll tell you, it makes me laugh if I get one. You know.
Yeah. No, it's good whip snap kind of a rhythm there. We don't want to quit. Elephant Rocks, the title poem from that volume. It's page 84 in the volume, Kay.
Oh, this is one of those few occasions, or this poem is a result of one of those few occasions when I actually had kind of a vision or an apprehension of something. I was out running in the hills in Marin County on the outskirts of Mount Tamalpais, and there are rocks that are partly out of the ground, and they suddenly took on I started feeling that they were elephants that were coming out of the ground. I wouldn't ordinarily say that much. If you were reading this poem to yourself, you should just be able to get everything out of it. But when you're just hearing it fly by you on the radio,
it helps.
I really like to give you a little intro. So here's Elephant Rocks. Here and there, at the edges and marges, a bit of an elephant surfaces, a dome and a dip, a haunch or an aspect of head, some worn away soft and yet angular hump of the shambling elephant armature, up through the earth, a bump or a knob with the elephant signature. The ancient, implacable creature comes ambling back, a bulge reemerges, that sober, that giveaway gray. The dirt rubs away from a treasure too patient and deep to be lost. However we've hurt, whatever we've done to the beasts, whatever we say.
Elephant Rocks. Okay,
I would I would add that I went home from my run and sat down and wrote that. I bring that up because it is not my way of working. I sit down with nothing on my mind and write, and I do it before I go for any runs or anything like that. So it was a highly unusual kind of situation.
Do you believe that? Is it too literal for me to see you saying there, you know, whatever we've done to the beasts, they just keep rising from the earth?
Well, I suppose it's a prayer.
We're greedy. Give us one more fast. Tune. It's page 67.
Which book?
Oh, geez.
Tune.
I'm going to have to... I'm so bad. I think it's your latest. I think it's Niagara.
Okay, good. Yeah, I think so, too.
Go straight to it, if you would.
I really need that thing I thought of, don't
yes,
I?
You do.
Okay, tune. Okay. Imagine a sea of ultramarine suspending a million jellyfish as soft as moons. Imagine the interlocking, uninsistent tunes of drifting things. This is the deep machine that powers the lamps of dreams and accounts for their bluish tint. How can something so grand and serene vanish again and again without a hint?
Our newly named poet laureate, in this season we might say our presumptive poet laureate.
Presumptuous.
Presumptuous. Kay Ryan reading there. tune from her collection, The Niagara River. We've worked you hard, but we're grateful, and I hope you'll come back maybe when your time is you're at the other end of it and tell us how it's been being our Grand Poet Laureate, Kay.
Well, I hope I can, Tom.
Just fantastic. Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Kay Ryan joined us there from San Francisco. She'll be the new Poet Laureate of the United States. You can read the poems you've heard this hour and more. Get to them through our website, onpointradio.org, or buy the books. And you can continue the conversation. Download the podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. On Point is produced by Julie Jopp, Ping Huang, Eileen Imada, Stefano Katsonis, Hillary McQuilkin, Tanya Rally, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and John Wibby, with help from Will Roselip, Sylvia Spring, and Samina Udine. Our senior producer is Wen Stevenson. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.